Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our CAs this morning and to the few interlopers who have come. We're absolutely delighted to have you here this morning because you're paying. The rest come free. You're the only commercial part of this venture this morning, so we're absolutely delighted. And the only thing I want to see is bring a friend the next time. Delighted to see so many of you here. There are only a few seats left, and I actually know within the next while it will be standing room only. It's reassuring and comforting, in fact inspiring, for the chief executive of the Institute to know that you can call an event and there is only standing room. We should be using this to announce the increase in subscriptions for next year. But we're delighted to have Alistair with us today. You know that we have been active in the debate, not taking sides, but in the public interest, engaging in a debate. And for those of you that were here when Nicola Sturgeon came, she stood at the same podium, she presented her case. And today, we have the opportunity to hear from Alistair Darling, former Chancellor, well known to you all, who is leading the Better Together campaign. It's hard to believe, but there is still a whole year to go. I mean, if I looked at the news yesterday, it commanded the front page of several yesterday. I do believe the Sun may have a front page this morning. Not that any of you would have bought the Sun this morning on the way to the event. I do believe it's there. It's also the front page of the Times, Scotsman, today. So we're getting it today. Interestingly, you saw the news. One poll says the No campaign lead 59% to 29%, with the undecideds that were 14% before are now down 4% to 10%. But yet this morning we'll read a survey supporting the Yes campaign, which says the Yes campaign leads by 1%. We know numbers, ladies and gentlemen, and it's difficult for the public to take comfort on which side is which in the debate. And this is where ICAST comes in. We will, in the public interest, ask the difficult questions. Some of you will recall the pensions paper that we produced, which actually we discovered it managed to command for 17 consecutive days the London press. We're looking for the next one that can do that. If any of you have any big ideas of how ICAST can get 17 days consecutive in the papers, please let us know. But we are looking. We're not giving it all away. Today, I'm not telling you what the next thought pieces are, but we are cooking several, which in the public interest will ask challenging questions, not to one side, but to both. But enough of me, ladies and gentlemen. Alistair will be presenting his view. We will have questions afterwards. So a warm welcome from ICAST to Alistair Darling.
Thank you very much indeed. When you reminded everyone that there is just over a year to go, I thought that was your attempt to try and empty the hall a bit, because to many people the prospect of a year-long election campaign is one of the most dismal things you could possibly contemplate. There is some considerable time to go, and since you mentioned polls, I would just think that any opinion poll done on a referendum 12 months before the event is pretty meaningless. And my view is that this will be a lot closer than people think. And that's why it's so important, because the decision that we take in 12 months' time won't be about electing a government for the next 5 years, and if you don't like it, you can kick them out and get another lot. It will be about the future direction of the country in which we live for maybe the next 200 or 300 years. And from the nationalist point of view, just remember this, they only have to win once by one vote, and that's it. There's no going back. So the stakes are high, and there is everything to play for on both sides, and that's why it's so important that whatever standpoint or whatever campaign you're in, we do our best to engage with the Scottish public as a whole. And that in itself is a challenge, because most people in Scotland, most people in the United Kingdom can take or leave politics and preferably leave it. And they can just about put up with a 3-4 week general election campaign, but a year is a long, long time. And that will be a challenge for both. Now, I want to put the case for Scotland being better and stronger together as part of the United Kingdom, I want to look at some of the arguments that are around, and then the rest of the time will be for you to put your points of view to ask questions. But there are, I think, three powerful reasons why we are better and stronger within the United Kingdom. They're economic in terms of the influence we have in the world, and you know, something deeper than that, the bonds that exist within the United Kingdom. And if you look at the economic argument, that to me seems to be overwhelmingly on the side of saying that it is in Scotland's best interest to remain part of the United Kingdom. My argument is not that we couldn't go it alone, although we'd be very dependent on oil as a source of revenue. My argument is we shouldn't, because it's not in our best interest to do so. And if you think about it, within the economic union, which is underpinned, of course, by a social and a political union, you have a market of 60 million people, not 6 million. And whatever you do, whatever you sell, whether you make things or you're providing services, you can sell what you do throughout the whole of the UK without having to think about any difficulties there might be in terms of transaction costs. Certainly you've got the same currency, so you don't have to worry about that. The regulations, by and large, particularly in the financial services industry, are the same. And that is a tremendous opportunity for people who are making things and buying and selling things across the border. I know it's sometimes said, well, look, we've got a single market in the European Union. Well, up to a point. Anyone who's ever looked at the European Union, the single market, will realise that sometimes it's not quite as single and it's not quite as open as you might hope. Within the United Kingdom, which is one of the oldest economic unions in the world, there are no barriers at all. And that's very, very important. There's a study being published, I think it's today or maybe tomorrow, by the UK government, which draws together academic research going back a number of years, which shows that if you look at trade across borders, it is far greater within a single economic unit than it is across borders, something like four times as much. And, for example, if you look at North America, where there is, of course, an economic union, the North American Trading Union, look between the United States and Canada, actually the trade within Canada and within the United States is far greater than across the Canadian-United States border, even when physically the two traders are much closer together. And that is very, very important, especially for a country like Scotland, which depends on its ability to buy and to sell things across borders in order to make our way and to create jobs in the future. And I cannot see for the life of me why you would want to put any barrier in the way of that. It's very, very important. Now, in addition, of course, to sharing those opportunities, not just in buying and selling things, there's other gains that come as well. For example, if you take renewable energy, you know, which is in parts of Scotland, it's very, very important. But that renewable energy is totally dependent upon a UK subsidy. And actually, we get something like 30% of the benefit, and we contribute about 10% of the cost of this. But if you move to a situation where in a separate country, that UK subsidy will simply not be available. And that, you know, is an example of where we can gain, because we are part of a whole, like a larger unit, where we accept that from time to time there are transfers across borders because of people's need, what work we're better at doing. Or if you take universities and research. In Scotland, we have four of our universities are in the world's top 200. France, which is a lot bigger than Scotland, has only got five. We do punch above our weight, but we also gain from having access to UK research funds. Now, if you're out of the United Kingdom, you simply don't get access to them. And I saw yesterday the principal of my own university saying, well, you could do. Well, yes, you could do, but I'm telling you, in practical political terms, if you decided to leave the UK, there are consequences. You know, the UK universities minister has made it clear that just simply wouldn't continue. And I just mentioned those two examples of ones where we actually gain from being part of something larger than our own country, and something that you'd have to think long and hard about before throwing that away. Now, in addition to sharing opportunities, you also pool risks. You also get the security of being part of a larger country. And I'll just give you two examples. One advantage of being part of a larger country is when you get shocks to the system, then you can more easily deal with them than otherwise. It's just 5 years ago next month when I received the only scary telephone call in my life. I'm often asked, when I was Chancellor of the Exchequer, which of my 1,000 days in number 11 was the worst, and I always reply, I'm somewhat spoilt for choice as far as that's concerned. This particular day, on the morning of the 7th of October 2008, will stay with me. It's the day when I got a call from the chairman of RBS, which at that time was one of the biggest, if not the biggest bank in the world. And you may remember its shares had been suspended by the stock exchange, and he rang me up and he said, "We're running out of money. What are you going to do about it?" And, you know, I said, "Well, how long can you last?" And I thought he'd say maybe a couple of days. And he said, "Well, at the current rate, we're going to run out of money in the early afternoon, maybe 2 or 3 hours. Now, you just think about it. If RBS had run out of money and shut its doors, it would have brought down the banking system in this country, and I suspect the banking system in the States and elsewhere. And we were able to do something about it because the UK was big enough to do it. Now, I remember, in contrast to that, speaking to my Irish counterpart, who you may remember the day afterwards, the Irish government decided to underwrite all three of its banks. And I remember speaking to Brian and saying, "You know, you can't do that. They're much bigger than the Irish state." And I remember him saying, "Yeah, I know. I hope no one finds out." They did actually find out about 20 minutes later. And, you know, the same with Iceland. And, you know, going back to the RBS point, to keep that bank going, the Bank of England rang up the Fed in the United States and said, "Will you make sure that bank has enough funding to carry on trading so it didn't collapse during the course of the American trading day?" Now, we could do that because the Americans didn't say, "Excuse me, who are you?" or "Can you afford to do this?" But because we had the clout, the financial strength of the UK, and remember, RBS's balance sheet was as big as the UK's GDP at that time, slightly bigger, actually, we could do that. And, I certainly hope we don't have another banking crisis, but when people come to look at the health of our financial institutions in the future, and if Scotland was independent, they will look at the size of the institutions relative to the size of the country's GDP. It's no accident, as people have said, that big financial institutions tend to be in bigger countries. And there's other examples too, not just of shocks to the system, but if you take, for example, the fact that our population is ageing more rapidly than the rest of the UK, why take that burden on 6 million people as opposed to 60 million people? There's a huge advantage here. Just as if you look at public spending in Scotland, as you know, public spending here is higher than it is in the rest of the UK, but it's stable. If you were dependent on 20% of your tax revenues, which Scotland has been coming from the North Sea oil, you are dependent on a very volatile source of income because the prices go up and they go down. In 2009, for example, in the space of 1 year, the tax revenues from oil that would come to Scotland fell by something equivalent to half what Scotland spends on its health. Now, if you're faced with that sort of in-year cut and you're a smaller country, well, you've no option but either to cut spending immediately, increase your borrowing, and if you're a new country, that can be problematic, or cut something else elsewhere. So, this is an example of where if you're part of a larger country, you get the benefit of stability, the benefit of simply being a larger economy, and an ability, therefore, to absorb the unplanned shocks to the system, as well as dealing with the longer-term challenges that all countries will face because you've got the strength to do that. So it seems to me, in terms of the opportunities and in terms of the pooling of risks, the sharing of the security, the arguments are overwhelmingly being part of the United Kingdom. I said there were two other arguments, and the next one I just want to look at briefly is in terms of influence in the world. Now, I'm not talking about some sort of grandiose Palmerstonian view of the world here. I want to start off by being practical. The European Union, which we are members of, and I think it's common ground that we'd all want to remain members of it, and I apologise if there's anyone from UKIP here, but I think the majority of people would want to remain within the European Union. The European Union, I know from my own experience, having attended ministerial council meetings every month for 13 years, is run by large countries. And if you want something done in Europe, you have to get a large country on side. And that is very, very important for us, especially, take financial services, for example, where the influence of the European Union is growing, and if France and other countries have their way, it will continue to grow further. And that impacts, I suspect, on what a lot of what you do here. So actually having clout and influence within the European Union matters. And why give that up? It's not just in financial services, it's in agriculture, it's just about every aspect of our lives. And of course, in the broader sphere of the world, of course, in the last few weeks, and last week in particular, we've been discussing about what the world can do about Syria, for example. Now, I'm not going to go into that today, but all I can say is that I think that is an example of where I hope a country like ours can be a force for reason and for good, But we can do that because we are a larger country. We're listened to in many ways by other countries who are much bigger than ours, because we do have influence. It is very, very important to us. And whether it's the IMF or the World Bank, the United Nations, we have influence. And I just don't see the benefit of giving that up. And then there's a third element, which is equally powerful. I'm Scottish, I live in Scotland, and I'm proud of being Scottish. But I'm also proud of being British. And I don't actually see why I should have to choose between the two. Why should I? I want to remain Scottish and British. You know, if you look at these islands, Scotland has contributed, a huge amount to what is now the United Kingdom. From the Enlightenment throughout the great developments in the Victorian times to modern times, we are hugely influential. The United Kingdom is just as much ours as if we were living in England, Northern Ireland or Wales. And I think that bond between the people in the United Kingdom, that is very, very important. You know, there's institutions like the NHS or the BBC, which bring a common endeavour, a common bond between us all. And I cannot for life me see why I'd want to move away from that. So then the three arguments, in terms of economic, in terms of opportunities, sharing the opportunities and sharing the risks together, in terms of what we can do in the world, not just for our own interests, but for the wider global interest, if you like, but also because of that strong emotional and cultural tie where we know, we live in a country which we are very proud of, but we know there's something bigger out there which we need to hold on to. Those are very, very powerful arguments. Now, it's often said in this debate about independence that we should, both either side should avoid being negative. And I said on the day that we launched our campaign just over a year ago that we will put forward and we'll continue to put forward a positive case for being part of the United Kingdom. But nobody is going to stop me from asking difficult questions of the other side. I mean, that's part of what political discourse is about. And when you think about it, if anyone comes to you later today and says to you in your firm or whatever, look, I've got a proposal that you should merge with me or be taken over or you should set up on your own, you'd be mad if you weren't saying, well, tell me how this works. Tell me about the figures. I want to just examine this. And so too with the future of our country. And, one of the things I learned early on is being negative is asking Alex Salmond a question to which he doesn't know the answer. And I'll continue to do that. You mentioned what ICAS have asked in relation to pensions. You know, their first response was they didn't know that pensions had to be funded, in countries individually. The second was, well, don't worry, we'll get a derogation. We'll be the only European Union member out of the other 27 that won't have to fund our pensions. Well, let's just see how we get on with that one. But it's an example where, techie question it may be, but actually if you're a beneficiary of one of these pension funds, you'd like to know whether or not it's going to have to be, funded. It's just an example of where, where if you ask questions, sometimes it's a wake-up call to people to realise that, this isn't some sort of pain-free, easy option where everything is going to be wonderful. Or if you take, for example, whether or not we would remain part of the European Union, we were told unequivocally there was a legal opinion that said that we would automatically remain the same the following day from independence as we were the day before. When we asked this, we were firstly accused of being negative. We were told that, we should just go away and forget ourselves. There is no legal opinion. It was never asked for. It didn't exist. And yet we were being invited to rely on that as a key part of the future of our country. Or, if you just take one other thing, which I think is going to be absolutely critical to this debate, and it's not an arcane matter, and that is the currency which we use. Now, when this debate started out, the nationalist position used to be that we'll join the euro. Now, the euro is as popular in Edinburgh as it is in Essex. It's got very, very few supporters. Then we would be told we would use the pound in the same way as Panama uses the US dollar. And when you think about it, your interest rates are then set by what would then be a foreign bank. You have no lender of last resort, which if you're a financial institution in this country, I think would probably cause some of your customers to begin to wonder whether it was a great idea to be doing business with you. Which is why they then say we'll have a currency union. Now, a currency union requires two things. One is it requires the agreement of the other lot to join it. Nobody has ever asked anyone in the rest of the UK whether or not they want to go into a currency union. And if you think this is just a formality, it isn't. Because a currency union, the second part of it, means that both sides have to agree that their budgets, what they tax, what they spend, what they borrow, are agreed between them. Now, you know, this is a big constitutional step, never mind an economic step. And if you look around what's going on in the Eurozone just now, you will see that they are struggling to try and create the very single market I was talking about against a background where you don't, you know, you have although you may have a single currency, you don't have the economic and the social and the political underpinning, the fiscal underpinning that you have in this country. And I just think, you know, there's two things that strike me with this currency union. One is, I don't think you'll get the agreement in the first place, but even if you did, it is not independence if you go to a situation where somebody else is telling you what you can tax and spend. Because that is the condition. And, you know, when you hear John Swinney and others saying, look, if only we had independence, we could have what he calls the full levers of the economy to help. One of the things they want to do is to cut corporation tax. Well, do you think for 1 minute the rest of the UK is going to enter into an agreement which will allow someone else to undercut you and your corporation tax just over the border? It just won't happen. And I think you know, this is absolutely fundamental to us. And if we don't get this currency union, then we don't have the pound. You know, because Alex Salmond just a few weeks ago went to the Isle of Man, where he wrongly claimed that they have a currency union with us, and he said that's the model of the future. Well, they do have a currency called the pound. If you go there, there's a note saying the pound, but it's not the pound sterling. And they're interchangeable in the Isle of Man, but you can't get anyone else to take the things. And, of course, they do use the pound sterling, as I say, in the way that anyone can if they want. We don't bother about it because the Isle of Man has a population about the size of Paisley, so it's not actually a big problem for us. But it's not a currency union. And, you know, that takes you, if you don't have a currency union, to actually having your own currency. And all I'd say about that is launching your own currency for a small country at a time like this would be, as they would say in Yes Minister, courageous. I just think you'd take an awful lot of thinking before you started to do that. But it's not the only issue. There's the whole question of regulation, the question of having a lender of last resort, which for a financial services industry here, which is ours, is much bigger relative to our GDP than most other countries. These things are very, very important. So I think there are very powerful reasons for staying part of the United Kingdom. And there are equally very powerful arguments against the proposition that is being put by the nationalists. And, the more you put it, the more striking it is. They try and tone things down, saying, actually, everything will change, but nothing will change, so don't really worry about it. You know, these are the arguments that have got to be exposed. The last thing I'd say to you is this, that if for the next 12 months this whole argument is one conducted between politicians on one side and politicians on the other side, that is a very good way of turning people off. Now, it's very difficult, and it's proved very difficult, to get people in business and outside politics to say anything. You know, and I understand the whole range of reasons why people might not. But I would just say this to you, whether it's collectively through ICAS, which you have done, or individually or through the firms that you work for, you know, it's your country, it's your debate. And sometime over the next 12 months, your voices need to be heard. Because, people do listen to what people in business have got to say. When you look around and you ask people in polls who do they trust, it won't surprise you to know that the least trustworthy, those two groups who stick out as being the least trustworthy, one is politicians, there's no surprise there. The only thing that cheers me up is the people who come actually below us are bankers, which is why I'm very fond of bankers, because I can always point to them. If anyone's an estate agent here, you've gone way up the parade since in the old days. But the people that people say they trust is the BBC is one. The other is businesses, because people may not agree with you, but people tend to take the view, if you've got a business and you're doing something, you might have something to say. So don't feel put off. It's your country, and don't wake up the next morning and say, well, I wish I'd said something. It's so important. So thank you for listening to me. I hope I have managed to persuade you that we are better and stronger together. But if not, then I intend to carry on again and again until polling day in September next year. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, without much ado, we would like to go to questions. Just before we begin, there will be microphones coming around. Please stand, give us your name and who you are. First gentleman here at the front, microphone, okay, Cara, and then second here. Cara, Cara. Please, if you'd like to stand.
Thanks very much, Fred Lawson. You haven't mentioned the Barnett formula, talking about talking to accountants about money in and money out. There's a lot of money comes in from the rich southeast. What's going to happen to that?
Am I answering questions individually, or
take that just now? Okay, right. I'll let them get some warm-up time.
It follows that if we leave the UK, then the Barnett formula goes. What you would get in exchange is the revenues from the North Sea. The point I would make about this is the Barnett formula, the way that funding in Scotland is done, does provide you with stability. We know how much is going to be coming in because it's automatic, if you like. And of course it changes as the amount of public spending changes in the UK, but it's there and you can plan against that. If, on the other hand, you move away from that and you rely on the North Sea, it's fine as long as the North Sea oil price remains high, and it's fine as long as people decide to keep extracting oil from the North Sea, which decisions mostly are made outside the UK. But you're always conscious of the fact that it's a finite resource. It will decline, and you're going to have to replace it with something else. I think that what would worry me is being so dependent upon that. I know that Alexander said recently that it wasn't the basis for independence, it was a bonus. Well, I don't know how on earth you can argue that 20% of your revenues are a bonus. I know that when the banking crisis hit, 25% of our corporate revenues came from the financial services sector, and they went through the floor, in a few weeks. And now you can absorb that in a big economy, but it's still a bit of a nuisance. It's one of these things you just have to deal with, I suppose. But it's one of the reasons our borrowing is so high at the moment. But I think moving from a situation where you have the certainty of the Barnett formula, and the cross-border flows, to the uncertainty that comes from being so dependent on one source of oil, that would worry me very much. And leaving aside the question of whether you now then start to build up an oil fund as well, which, you can't spend the same money twice.
Okay, thank you. Yes, here.
Hamish McKenzie. You say better together, you see, but I wonder better together with what? It's better together at the moment with a country that is largely bankrupt, is a subsidy junkie to the tune of over £100 billion a year, corrupt in many areas as has been shown, run by a public school clique from Eton, nationalistic and in my view class ridden. I'm not sure that's the country I want to be together with, frankly. That's not right.
Well, I think that's a personal opinion.
it's not for me to defend the Conservatives. That's what we're getting at. But not in a Conservative government. You make a general point, about the sort of country we want to live in. Where I would disagree with you is that somehow England and the English are inherently bad, and Scotland and what we might hear is inherently good. There's lots of things you can point to in Scotland where, you can say, for example, you use the pejorative term subsidy junkie. If you take Scotland, the dominant political view, and certainly of the nationalists, is you'd actually have more public spending and some of them will admit to higher taxes and so on. The idea is that it's a difference in character traits, I think, I simply don't agree with you. There are lots of people living in Edinburgh, Manchester, and London, who take your view in terms of, the people that are currently running the country. But I don't think these divides are driven by national identity. They're really about, how people feel generally. In terms of the country, it's not bankrupt. Come on.
£2.5 million's not bad, more than I've got.
Yeah, it may well be, and I don't know how well your practice has been going, but it's. That's very good. But I just think when you ask for the better together, what I'm saying is Scotland, for economic, social, and political reasons, is better together being part of the United Kingdom. I do not see any advantage of us splitting away from it, where actually many of the problems you refer to, I suspect, will still be there, although they may manifest themselves in slightly different ways.